Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to the Metrospective presented by Topps. Check out Topps Project 70, celebrating 70 years of Topps baseball cards. I'm Ted Berg, joined once again, returned from his wedding celebration, the Athletics Mets beat writer, Tim Britton. Tim, congratulations again.
Oh, thank you. Yes, it was really nice. The Mets made a trade the day of the reception, and I saw the MLB trade rumors note on it, and then I turned my phone over, and I was good to go the rest of the day.
It is the one day, maybe of like the birth of children, I say also, where we're like, no one's going to get on you about the Mets made a fairly minor trade on the day you're getting married, right? Like, that is a day you are safe to turn your phone off.
It's funny because there was someone who cut, I'd written at the start of last week that I was going to take a few days off for this purpose. And someone had written that, Connor Hughes, our Jets writer, had a similar situation where he took off for his wedding, but there was news that broke that day, and he did tweet about it shortly before his wedding ceremony and or reception. And my wife saw that comment and basically told me that would not be happening on Friday, and I was in total agreement with that.
Totally reasonable. I was cut off, as I believe we've discussed before on the show. I was on my honeymoon for almost the entirety of the shirtless Tony Bernazard scandal and subsequent press conference, and I was pulled from my cell phone and to like the wonders of Costa Rica by my wife, who was like, "You don't have to worry about this right now," and she was right. And but the Mets, we do have to worry about. Do we have to worry about? We feel okay about after yet another doubleheader split, and another one where they do the thing where the good one comes second. So we feel a little bit more optimistic coming out of it, especially after just a brilliant performance up and down from the bullpen in a bullpen game featuring some names that you don't necessarily expect are gonna shut down the Braves.
Yeah, I mean they. Between the two games, really, after Marcus Stroman departed the first game after five innings, they had seven different pitchers throw nine innings of shutout baseball against the Braves. And, they went through basically their entire bullpen with that. I think they had two guys who did not pitch yesterday in the bullpen. Maybe three. But, they got the guy who pitched the most in the nightcap was Anthony Bonda.
Who earned his Miller Lite, yeah.
Who got his Miller Lite post-game right next to
mid-drink beers. That's like, that should be on a t-shirt for them, for this like very bro-y Mets team.
That is like the image of them like around a small table with their two beers. I mean, it was very like, that's what people imagine our podcast is, right? Like the two of us sitting around a small table right next to each other. While drinking light beer. Bonda pitched well over those two innings. That they matched up well. Luis Rojas, I thought, deployed the bullpen well he made sure he had his lefties for that top of the order for Atlanta, who didn't change their lineup at all. So it was Peterson, Albies, and Freeman right at the top.
I want to cut you off. I have a question about that. So mm-hmm. When you have a TBA starter in a game, at what point do you have to say who the starter is? Do you have up until you bring the lineup card out? Because doesn't that like then doesn't it, if you were, and again the Braves, like you said, were keeping their lineup static, but if you were facing a team like the Rays or one of these, so many teams that change up a lot based on matchups, why would you ever say who your starter is before until like game time?
My understanding is it is due at a certain point, like before the other team sets its lineup.
Okay.
The other team could probably, you know, the Braves could have put in their lineup, the minute the first game ended, before hearing that Loop was the starter for the Mets. But I think the Mets are like obligated to or obliged. I forget. I never know which one.
It would certainly be ungentlemanly in like the, in keeping with baseball tradition, but. It feels like if that was something you could do, someone would have done it by now.
Right. You know, I mean, we saw it in the NLCS, what, in 2018 when the Brewers started Wade Miley and pulled him after a batter against the Dodgers. That the three batter rule takes care of that a little bit. But, you know, I was still surprised, given that Loop was starting the game, that the Braves didn't move Peterson in the order or even put him on the bench to start with. That would have changed, I think, the way the Mets went about it the rest of the way. But I thought, you know, Luis Rojas took advantage of that. And, you know, you saw the depth of the Mets pen. Like, you used Loop, Familia, May, Diaz, Lugo, and Banda in that game. And really, you know, outside of Banda, the other five guys are kind of, you know, guys you can kind of sort of trust in high leverage situations. And they have at various points this season. Every Mets fan is rolling his eyes about like Edwin Diaz more than anyone else. But you know, like Diaz has pitched better the last few times.
Yeah, I was going to say
Lugo and May are your primary setup men, along with Loop the way he's pitched of late. And Familia has been, you know, he's not lights out, but he's pitched better this year than he has in the past couple, and has been an important part of that bullpen. Like him and Miguel Castro. Are the guys, if you're going to do this, you need those guys to pitch well, and they did on Monday.
Yeah, and Familia, I thought, you know, like you said, you know, he's been wild and still sort of effective all season, and like it feels like there's some smoke and mirrors element to it, and maybe he's not as good as the results have been, but a really strong outing for him, striking out the side after two really fluke hits. And then I thought, to me, the big takeaway from this game and from the last couple of days was Edwin Diaz. As I'm sure you heard when you pressed pause on your wedding celebration to listen to Eno and I on the podcast last week, we discussed Diaz and his struggles. And I know you've written about them, Diaz's struggles since the sticky stuff enforcement. It does look now like at the very least, he's not just going to be bad moving forward. Like if he has, maybe he has made the necessary adjustment to get back to being very good. Maybe that remains to be seen. But I think there was some looming concern for some of us, the doomsday Mets fans among us, myself included, that, oh, maybe Edwin Diaz was like purely, and knowing rationally that this couldn't be true, but well, what if Edwin Diaz was like purely a function of spider tack and now he can't use it and he's just going to be bad? That doesn't seem like that's going to be the case.
Yeah, I mean, I think for really across the league, when you see pitchers who, you know, are experiencing the drop in spin rates and a consequent drop in their results in the immediate aftermath of June 21st and the enforcement of the foreign substances ban, like it's not the really, really good pitchers who are just, you know, no one's going to go from like being Gerrit Cole to being like a number five starter. Like Gerrit Cole, like it's going to take some adaptation. It's going to take a period of adjustment. But you know, Gerrit Cole might not be the dominant force that he was previously, but he's still going to be a very good starting pitcher. And Edwin Diaz might not be quite the shutdown closer that, you know, he's probably never going to be the shutdown closer he was in 2018, regardless, in Seattle. But he still has the stuff to be a very good closer. It's really just a matter of commanding his fastball. And you know, when he came out on Monday and like poured in the first two pitches, first two fastballs in the strike zone, you feel pretty good about how the rest of that outing is going to go. Mm-hmm. It's kind of, you know, look, Mets fans are used to seeing this with closers over time. You know, John Franco was the same way.
I think fans of every team except the Yankees and maybe the Padres are used to seeing that with closers over time, right? Like the thing that made Mariano Rivera so notable was that he never had that year where it didn't work, or he never had that, you know, like it feels like a closing is just sort of a fickle occupation in general, and it's only the very, very special ones who are able to maintain it for very long.
Exactly. Like it, and I think it's really just Rivera. Even Hoffman was not quite as automatic.
And Rivera, if you'll recall, like late in his career, Rivera would occasionally have like back-to-back outings where he allowed a hit. And then if you turned on WFAN, you'd hear like Rivera's done.
I mean, and I think there is a, you know, like Mariano Rivera blew game 7 of the World Series. And I am sure there are members of the Yankees fan base who have never forgiven him for that. Like, regardless of how good he was the rest of the time, they'd be like, ah, yeah, but still, Luis Gonzalez, you know?
Right.
And, you know, if I can imagine the Mets fans treating him the same way had he pitched for them and pitched as well and as many times in the World Series for them as he did for the Yankees.
For sure. Let's talk about the rest of the series, I guess. It does. We don't need to get into the game by game matchups, although the Braves have some good starters coming out after some less experienced ones on Monday. But as Eno and I discussed, and I know you wrote about, and as I know, I believe Zach Scott himself mentioned, this is a really, really big three games coming up because of where the Mets and Braves are respectively in their division. The Mets sweep the Braves here. I think the Braves season is more or less over.
Yeah, I mean, coming into Monday, Atlanta, like it's 5 games in 4 days, and it ends right before the trade deadline. Like their last game before the trade deadline is the last game of this series, and they could have been, the Braves could have been tied with the Mets and presumably in first place at that point, or they could have been as many as 10 games behind them. Which is an insane amount of swing possible in such a short period of time and in such a critical period of time that it is happening right this week. You know, the split on Monday narrows that range, but it's still, they could be as close as 2 games or as far out as 8 games. And even like the difference between 4 and 6 is pretty big in my mind. Mm-hmm. That 4, you feel like you're there, and 6, it's, you know, I think I looked, there are 2 teams since the change of the playoff system in 2012, 2 teams that have been 6+ games out at the trade deadline who won the division anyway. Both in 2015, the Blue Jays and Rangers were 6 and 7 out respectively. And, you know, Alex Anthopoulos was the GM of those Blue Jays, and that's the team that went and traded for Troy Tulowitzki and David Price. There's a reason they came back. I don't think the Braves look at this the same way. This, I don't think Anthopoulos looks at this Braves team the same way he did as that Blue Jays team, which had, I think was under 500, but had like a great run differential and just seemed like it should have been better than it was at that point in the season.
Well, and especially in the absence of Acuna, you can't, it's not the same Braves team it was in May.
Exactly. So I don't expect that same kind of pushing all the chips in. So this is like, you know, Zach Scott said, you know how you perform this week may determine how another team in your division, how another rival approaches its trade deadline. You know, like the Braves, if they're 8 games out, they're probably trading Jock Peterson again, trading him away rather than trading for him. And maybe they move Charlie Morton or something like that. If they're 2 games back, they're looking to add someone else into that mix in their rotation or in their outfield. So it is a pivotal moment in Atlanta's season, which makes it important for the Mets, because if you can, you know, the Nationals seem like they're on the outskirts here. They're, I think, now 8 games back or something like that. Then if you can bury the Braves over the next 3 games, push them to 6 or 8 back, that might get them out of the picture. And then it's just the Mets and Phillies. And, you know, the Phillies won a big game Monday night with Andrew McCutchen's walk-off home run against Washington. But that's still, I don't think if you polled baseball executives at the start of the season or Mets fans right now, that the Phillies are the team whose talent scares you the most in the division compared to Atlanta or even Washington. I think the you know, they've still got flaws. It'll be interesting to see how Dave Dombrowski, a notoriously aggressive general manager or president of baseball ops, approaches the next few days for them to see what he adds, because that's another team that could use starting pitching, and I don't know that there is the move out there that really puts you on notice if you're the Mets. But it, you know, if the Phillies go out and trade for Chris Bryant, or you know, bring in I don't know if they've got the horses to get Jose Berríos or something like that, or Kyle Gibson. That does, you know, that makes the Mets perk up a little bit. But you'd rather it be a two-team race between you and Philadelphia than a three-team one with Atlanta right there.
Yeah, Bryant's a good fit for the Phillies too, because they could use some help in center field. They could use help at third base. They could, like, he'd play real well in that park. I think another thing that scares me about the Phillies is Aaron Nola finally looking like he pulled it all together and having a great start over the, I think, yesterday, or maybe Sunday. Just because behind Zach Wheeler, their starting rotation has been so lousy this year that it's been sort of like, to me, the thing you can point to and be like, okay, I don't need to worry about the Phillies that much. And so Nola shaping up and pitching like the AC can be a little concerning. But let me ask you this, because we talked about how these next three games affect the Braves' deadline strategy. Is there a way, I haven't thought this all the way through, but is there a possibility they impact the Mets strategy too? Because the way I'm thinking about it, if you win these three games, if the Mets win these three games, they bury the Braves. If the Phillies don't assert themselves over the next three games, and the Mets look like they have a pretty comfortable lead in the division moving forward. And then to me, it's not, oh, do we need to push to get there? It's we need to stock ourselves up to have the best playoff roster. And to me, that means Max Scherzer. I would say, if you think you're gonna make the postseason, and your concern is mainly how do we line ourselves up for the best postseason, then Scherzer is by far the most obvious difference maker out there, because we know the value of starting pitching in a postseason. If DeGrom is healthy, you line up Scherzer and DeGrom and then Scherzer in games one and two of a postseason series, I think it makes you a favorite, maybe even against a team like the Dodgers, just because of the strength of your top two in the rotation. If they're not pulling ahead of things after these next three games, if the Braves sweep them and all of a sudden it looks like, oh, there's two viable competitors in the division, to me, that makes it seem like a guy like a position player, like Javi Baez, Trevor Story, someone who can help them day to day and help them make that push for the postseason is a little more. And I don't know if this makes logical sense, so just help me talk that out. But is there a chance that there's a difference in strategy depending on how these games go?
I think I don't think it's a huge difference in strategy. I think the one thing you might think about differently if you're the Mets front office is about the need for a shortstop in particular, because, you know, Francisco Lindor is going to be out probably still another 3 to 5 weeks. So you're saying, you know, mid to late August, probably you're probably looking at like August 15th to August 30th on a return for Lindor. And, you know, Jonathan Villar has played defensively okay there. Luis Guillorme surprisingly didn't play his best at shortstop so far in Lindor's stead. You know, if it's really tight in the division, you might feel a little bit more compelled if you're training for a position player to make sure that position player can play shortstop for you in the meantime. Mm-hmm. You might prioritize a Story or a Baez over someone like Bryant, because then, you know, Lindor comes back, you can move probably Story to third or Baez to second, something like that. I think if they're more comfortable in the division by Friday, you know, if they're 8 up on Atlanta and maybe push out the lead over Philly to 4.5 or something like that, then you probably don't worry as much about getting someone in that can replace Lindor in the meantime, since you're confident he's going to be back by the stretch run and certainly the postseason. And you start thinking more about, like you said, setting up for October. I think they want pitching either way, because it's not like the lead over Philly is not going to be big enough to feel totally comfortable. You know, Zach Scott said it on Monday, that he's experienced it before. The fastest way for things to fall apart is right. For your starting rotation to fall apart. The Mets fans know that from 2007, when you're starting Mike Pelfrey and Philip Umber down the stretch. Scott knows it from the 2011 Red Sox, which was my first year covering baseball on a beat, covering mm-hmm. that team. And you saw early in that month of September, a month that they entered with, I forget if it was 8.5 or 9.5 game lead, in the wild card over Tampa Bay, that their rotation was a mess. It was going to be a problem. And they ended up starting, I think Kyle Weiland was the rookie, and Andrew Miller, who you know had yet to make his successful transition to the bullpen.
Yeah, remember that Andrew Miller, when he was just a starting pitcher, was like just like one of the worst starting pitchers in history. I'm sorry to say, like, he was real, real bad results wise as a starter.
So you know they went 7-20 in September. Their starting rotation ERA was over 7. Their ERA was higher than their number of wins that month. You know, like that is the fear. If you are somewhat comfortably ahead, as those two teams I just mentioned were, that if you know Jacob DeGrom doesn't come back, if Carlos Carrasco isn't healthy, if you know David Peterson is out for longer, you know you're already out Lucchesi. You don't know about Syndergaard. If like none of those guys are back pitching decently for you in the month of September, that basically no lead you have is safe. And so I expect them to add at least one pitcher just to have the depth in case more bad things happen to their rotation. Because we've talked about injuries all season. The Mets have been hit really hard by them. But when we came into this year, the thought was that it was going to be tough for pitchers in particular in the second half of the year because of the innings and how many more innings they're going to be throwing this year over last. It's been really an issue for every team throughout the season already, and it's probably going to get worse. Like, it's really hard to look at any pitcher, regardless of their track record of durability. Like Marcus Stroman has been a very durable pitcher. He's made every start this season for the Mets, and I think he just left the one. Has pitched a lot of innings for them so far. There's no in a normal season you'd say like you feel really good about Marcus Stroman making all the starts down the stretch. But this year, you know, just like any other pitcher, you have to worry about, you know, I guess especially him. He didn't throw at all last year. Like how he handles throwing his 160th, 180th inning in 2021 after throwing so few last year.
Yeah, I think, I mean, to me, the big one is Walker, who was such a big part of their first half success, has had a couple of clunkers of starts to start the second half. And when you look at the stats, you see he hasn't thrown, like last year he threw 53 and a third innings. That was his first time throwing more than 50 innings since he missed basically all of 2019 and all of 2018. He's already in sort of like the question mark zone for innings. And there's still a couple months of the season left. Maybe this is just a bump in the road and Walker will right himself and pull it together. And I think you have to hope you can count on him. But it's hard to say objectively, like, oh, yeah, like, Ty Walker, we're good. I mean, we're rolling with him through September. Not that they're going to take him out of the rotation or anything like that. That would be drastic. Just you have to be a little bit concerned because of how few innings he's pitched in the last few seasons.
Right. I mean, he's thrown more innings this year than he had from 2018 to 2020 by a fair margin already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think he's on pace to throw just about his career high, which is back in 2015, of close to 170. So, yeah, like I think that's the reason that that Zach Scott has said throughout the lead up to the trade deadline. He said it for more than a month that starting pitching is the top priority for a team. Like, you know, there's a part of you that wants to think like, you know, okay, if you feel good about where you are in the division, you feel good about DeGrom coming back, you feel good about Carrasco coming back. You feel Syndergaard it could be an option for you in September. Maybe you don't need that. You don't need a starter because you can have those four guys as your you know, along with Stroman and or Walker. Like you can get a postseason rotation out of that. Then you worry about some other upgrade you can make. But I think it's really hard for me to believe that their starting rotation in the postseason, should they get there, would be like a healthy DeGrom, Stroman, Walker, Carrasco, or something like that. I think that there will probably be an obstacle in the way of that going forward, and that's why you've got to be prepared for it, because there is no August 31st deadline anymore. There's no way to just add like in 2015 when they added Addison Reed, that was a huge move that they made in the month of August. In 2006 it was Sean Green who I believe they got in the month of August. So a lot of that little extra wiggle room you had before the waiver deadline on August 31st is gone, and I think that makes it, you know, you've got to prepare for more bad possibilities now than you would have in the past.
What is the latest on Jacob DeGrom, and how does does DeGrom status? Because again, this is one of these things where to me, it's like, look, if I feel good that Jacob DeGrom is coming back and is going to be healthy, and obviously there's only so confident you could be in that at this point. But if you say, look, he felt great, he just threw off the mound, we're all systems go with DeGrom, we can count on him, or at least, you know, we can reasonably hope to count on him in the postseason. Again, to me, that drives up the appeal of Scherzer, which is like a little bit counterintuitive because it means like, why add another ace when you've got one ace? But again, because like, to me, this team's success in the postseason right now, the way it's like, is DeGrom healthy? And if it's yes, then I like the Mets' chances against just about any team because you got DeGrom starting two games in a seven-game series or in a five-game series. If no, then it's like, oh, do you really want to go all in and trade for Max Scherzer when you're not sure DeGrom's going to be around and you're maybe, you know, you're putting all this together for a first-round loss?
Yeah, I mean, so the Mets said on Monday, you know, DeGrom has thrown a light side session. He's due to throw another one soon. So he's back throwing, which is good because he had been shut down for a little bit. But he hasn't thrown like the full bullpen session that we're used to him throwing. And he hasn't thrown to hitters yet. And that's the next big step for him is when does he throw to hitters? And then once he does that, you know, we'll see if he gets a rehab start. I would guess that he does, considering that he got one earlier in the year when he had missed less time. He gets a rehab start and then probably comes back into the rotation. So I still think you're looking that he's at least, you know, once he faces hitters, you've got to think he's 10 days away. So if he's a couple days away from that, he's probably at least 2 weeks away from returning. Scott said on Monday that they don't expect it, you know, he's had all these short-term issues. They don't think this is any different from those. It has already been longer term than any of the others. He's missed more time. Now to this point than he had at any other point. And you know, it will end up being at least a month, I think, between starts for him. So like it's more concerning than it has been at the earlier points in the season when he missed time for the Mets. But it does seem like they are optimistic that, you know, they might have to manage him down the stretch. And especially if they have a more comfortable lead in the division, they can do that without as much concern. And then they can kind of unleash him fully in the postseason if they get there. But I think, you know, kind of either way you look at it, to me, it makes Scherzer the guy you want because he's DeGrom insurance. Like if you, you know, the Mets have really liked the way their team is built for the postseason with, you know, DeGrom at the top of the rotation and some of the other pitchers they have. And if
especially
he's not
if
fully
the
healthy,
if the offense seems to be clicking now, or the doubleheader notwithstanding,
right? They've got enough kind of track record bats that, you know, if a couple guys come through and get hot in the postseason, you feel good about it. If DeGrom isn't healthy, I mean, you can think like, well, this team is going nowhere. Why bother? But also Scherzer gives you kind of theoretically what they thought they had already. Not quite as good as DeGrom, especially this season. But someone who is in that same class, basically, or as close to that class as anyone else is.
And a horse, right? Like a guy who just has not, I mean, I know he had a little bit of a back issue this year, but a guy who really has not missed much time at all in his career.
Right. I remember he fouled the ball off of his face in batting practice.
That's
and
right.
Broke his nose and then started later that day or the next day or something like that. I feel like we've got to qualify any conversation about Scherzer and the Mets as very unlikely to happen.
Okay.
I think because as I wrote about on Tuesday morning, like there are several different hurdles that the Mets would have to get over here. And it's is Washington sincerely interested in trading Max Scherzer? This is a guy that they want very much to be the first player who goes into the Hall of Fame with a curly W on his cap for them. And trading him, especially, you know, trading him to another team at this point in his career could harm that possibility, especially, you know, to a division rival. You don't want to see him excel necessarily with a division rival. So that's the second obstacle is if Mike Rizzo is you know, interested in trading Scherzer, it's probably easier for him to trade him to, first of all, the American League, but second of all, a team, you know, out in the NL West that right. wants Max Scherzer, whether it's the Dodgers or the Giants. You know, I doubt the Padres, but who knows? The Padres could always add.
It feels like, to me, it feels like the Dodgers are the inevitability, just because they always have the depth and prospects to make these deals. They always have the way to take on the salary, and they always seem to swing it, you know, like that. So, and they have the obvious need in the starting rotation and a team that's built to win now. So I would say, like, if, I don't know, it seems like if you're looking for a landing spot, that's a potential one for Scherzer.
Yeah, I would say they are the favorite to get him. If he is indeed dealt. The third obstacle is and Scherzer's no trade protection. He's a 10 and 5 guy, 10 years in the majors, 5 with the last team. So he can veto anything. You know, the Washington Post, Jesse Darty, reported on Monday that, you know, Scherzer doesn't really plan to veto trades as much as he just kind of wants to, you know, if there are multiple teams interested in him, he might steer Washington in one direction over another. I don't know how he feels about the Mets or New York pitching there, and whether that would, you know, make it more likely he ends up in Queens or less likely. And then if the Mets get through all that and you know, the Nats are good with trading Scherzer, they're okay with trading him in the division, and Scherzer likes the idea of pitching in New York, then you talk about price. And the price is going to be probably more significant for him than any other rental, even rental position players. And, you know, the last pitcher, I think, of his stature that was moved at the deadline was David Price. The last pitcher of his stature who was a rental, you know, the guys like Verlander and Greinke were moved. They had years left on their contract and a lot of money coming to them at a higher age. So Price was, I think that was 2015. Yeah, it goes from Detroit to Toronto. We talked about that Blue Jays team. And, you know, the big piece in that trade that hasn't worked out for the Tigers was Daniel Norris, who was a top 20 prospect in baseball heading into that year. So that would be kind of like the Francisco Alvarez part of that puzzle. And then there were some other, you know, I think it was Jairo Laborte, who was like the Tigers' eighth best prospect, or sorry, the Blue Jays' eighth best prospect at the time, and Matthew Boyd, who had just made his debut in the major leagues for Toronto at the time of the trade. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you're looking, that package is something along the lines of like Francisco Alvarez, a David Peterson, Tyler McGill kind of type would be Boyd. And then Laborte would be, I don't know, like Jalen Palmer maybe. So that's a pretty hefty price to pay. And I think you can make the argument that it'd be worth it for the Mets, but that is, they are probably not interested in trading Francisco Alvarez for anyone else. And that includes guys with years of control. And I honestly, I would be surprised if they moved him even for Scherzer. So I think if we're handicapping where Max Scherzer is going to end up, the Mets are not at the top of that leaderboard, and they're probably not second either.
I would say to the Nationals, if you really want Francisco Alvarez, like, spice up the deal with Trey Turner, and we could talk.
Yeah, and then you're probably throwing in, you know, Ronnie Mauricio,
Jeff McNeil. You're gonna have to pony up if you're. Yeah, I am not serious. I think I would be surprised if they, like, it doesn't seem likely that they land Scherzer. It's just he seems like, so by far, like the sexiest name on the deadline this year. Although there are some others, right? Because we mentioned Chris Bryant, we mentioned Javi Baez, we mentioned Trevor Story. We will speak again before the trade deadline, I think. But come Friday at 4:30 p.m. Eastern Time, when the dust settles, will the Mets have a player, if not of Scherzer's caliber, than a one of that tier of the big name guys? Are they gonna? Do you think that they will be big game hunting at the deadline here?
I think it's, I would say it's better than a 50-50 shot that they have someone who they trade for someone who has made the All-Star team previously. And I'm trying to think of like
like a guess who game. Yeah, go on.
Right. I'm trying to think of like who would fit that criteria, but still be like a disappointment. I'm not, you know, it's not like they're going to add Adrian Gonzalez between now and then. And like when they built that bunch of like 2011 All-Stars on the 2018 Mets, you know, I think
to Miguel Cabrera.
Yeah, like I think they're probably the front runners for Bryant. And I think he's still, they're the team that still makes the most sense for him. Like, I think there are other teams that make sense for Chris Bryant. They're, you know, like the A's make sense for him, the Phillies make sense for him, the Braves and Nationals until recently made sense for him. But those are not the teams that typically there's a little less reason for them to make that big A splash. You know, Oakland's not a team that makes that kind of trade. too often. They haven't really since 2014 with the Lester trade, and that blew up on them. The Phillies, you know, Dombrowski is the type that would make that trade, but also where they are in the standings, I don't know that that's the deal he makes, or whether he just looks to add pitching, especially for that starting rotation, which could really use two guys. So I would expect the Mets, like I think Bryant, they are the front runner for. I don't know that I give them a better than 50% chance of landing him specifically, but I think between him, Story, Baez, I guess has Jonathan Scope made the All-Star team? That would be one of the.
I feel like he has, right? Because he was the best player on the Orioles for a couple of years.
Yeah. He made it in 2017. Like that's another guy that they could potentially pick up. I don't think he would qualify quite the same way. I'll acknowledge that in the lead up. And then I think they add at least one more starting pitcher. I've said John Gray a lot in the last couple of weeks. I think he's the guy who makes the most sense in terms of price and attainability. And what he could do for them. But I think if they do add Gray, they probably look to add another arm of the Rich Hill ilk. The Hilk.
I was wondering about that. A guy you mentioned, and he's having a rough year, and you mentioned the divisional tax before. But when you talk about like reliability, at least for health, John Lester has basically like never missed a start in his career, and he signed to the Nats on a one-year deal. Again, having a rough season, but is that a Rich Hill type guy they might target?
I mean, that's possible. Like I thought about him a month ago. I guess before the Nats had made their charge, and you were first starting to look at what the trade landscape could be. And I wondered if Lester would make some sense for the Mets. It's like, you know, a nice veteran guy to have in the clubhouse. You'd probably like John Lester to spend some time with David Peterson or someone like that.
Yeah, like slow heartbeat. But he's been to the postseason a bunch of times. Like, that's a guy who knows what he's doing.
When I asked around about that possibility, and you know, this is four to 6 weeks ago, and what I heard from people in the Mets front office and elsewhere is just that, like, the stuff has backed up so much for Lester that you would be trading for him essentially just for the clubhouse presence. Right. And you know, maybe because of the way things have changed for the Mets, where they do just want innings out of someone. And you know, Hill is not exactly the guy you trade for when you're looking for an innings eater. That maybe Lester does make a little bit more sense. But you are looking at a guy who really over the last three seasons now, it's over 300 innings of a 4.7 ERA. 10% worse than league average. So just hasn't been, you know, the guy that he was before that, which makes perfect sense. He's 37 years old.
Right.
But, you know, I think he's like someone in that vein might be kind of a secondary addition for them in the next couple days.
Well, I want to get to a question, but I just want to emphasize a point you made in your column, which I liked, which was the idea of, and it seems fairly obvious at this point, of piggybacking starters once you start working Carrasco and possibly Syndergaard and DeGrom and everyone else back in the rotation, because they will at some point, if everybody gets healthy or something close to healthy, have more guys than they have rotation spots. And I couldn't help but thinking that when I was watching Rich Hill pitch for the Mets for the first time, what it would look like to an opposing hitter to face Rich Hill twice and then Noah Syndergaard.
Right, that one is, I think, the most jarring back-to-back you could put together. I mean, I think even Hill to McGill, and maybe I'm just saying that because of the rhyme, would be a good one. I've said before that McGill's success against right-handers in particular makes me think he could be useful in the bullpen, even if you bump him from the rotation. And you can imagine, you know, Hill gives you 12 outs or so, or a turn and a half through the lineup, and then you go to McGill for another turn through the order, and then you get to your big time guys out of the bullpen. That could be a nice combination for you in the regular season. I don't think you look at doing that in the playoffs quite the same way, but it could be a way to eat some innings if you get all of these guys back. You know, if you've got DeGrom, Stroman, Walker, Carrasco, Hill, McGill, Syndergaard makes his way back at some point. You can think about doing that to kind of preserve some guys' innings counts, that you're not pushing DeGrom or Walker to go 7 or 8 on any kind of consistent basis, and also, you know, have an effective tandem starter, essentially.
Our question today comes to us from Sweden. Philippe is a regular listener to the show. He is fairly new to baseball. He says he is just falling in love with the Mets and baseball this year. So he has a question. He has a few questions, but the first he asks, and it's interesting. It's an interesting perspective because this is something that someone who is fairly new to baseball might wonder. Whereas if you've been following it, you might wonder the other side. Philippe wants to know, why is it just 10 teams that make the postseason? It seems like a lot of good teams miss, and maybe it is too hard to make the playoffs.
Well, I think it's funny because I think if either of us were asking the question, well, certainly me, I don't want to put words in your mouth, the question would be, why do as many as 10 teams make the playoffs? You know, like baseball has always been the sport of the long game, the long season. You play 162 games or 154 for a long time. To separate the best from the rest. It's the sport that has a lot of variance in a short series situation. You know, like the difference between a team that goes 93 and 69 and a team that goes 69 and 93 is one game every seven. So that's right. That's the difference in a seven-game series. So, you know, you want to kind of, you know, the playoffs in any sport, but especially in baseball, are basically about entertainment value. Like the reason you have playoffs is because people enjoy watching tournament style situations, but you also don't want to, you know, totally undermine the point of having a regular season. You don't want a regular season to be completely meaningless, where you have, you know, consistently like, oh, like they went 78 and 84, but got hot in the playoffs and won. Nobody likes the 2006 Cardinals.
And I feel like in baseball that would happen all the time. Unlike, and I don't know hockey as well to compare it to, but with the NBA, the team that plays better in a basketball team wins the game, right? Like, because ultimately it's about taking good shots. And if you are taking good shots, they are going in and you know, preventing good shots, right? Right. Like, whichever team is taking more good shots is going to win the basketball game. Whichever team in baseball hits the ball hard more times, like that doesn't mean you're going to win, you know, like if there's just so much luck involved. And so to me, it's that like the 162 game season is what's necessary or probably not even like it's not even quite adequate for doing it. But it is as close as we're going to come to eliminating the factor of luck and determining the best teams. And so as sort of like from a traditional standpoint there, to me, it's like, well, you shouldn't let the teams that are like, unless you can distinguish yourself over the course of 162, you don't deserve to make the postseason.
Yeah. And you look in Major League Baseball, it's relatively rare that you get the top seeds in both leagues in the World Series. It was kind of ironic that it happened last year when you had the shortest regular season. You still got the Dodgers and Rays. You know, I remember when the 99 NLCS happened, which is the greatest baseball series ever played, and don't let anyone tell you differently until the last batter. You know, like that Mets Braves series was an awesome series. I can still totally buy the argument, like, why did the Mets even like what did the Mets do to earn that opportunity? Like, the Braves can beat them over 162 games, beat them individually in those matchups. I think that was back when they only played 12 times. The Braves probably went 9-3 in those 12 games against the Mets that season. Like, you know, if the Mets had won that seven-game series, it would have sucked if you were a Braves fan. Like, we just beat this team for 6 months. Why do we have to beat them again for another week? And I'm sympathetic to that argument. Certainly, the Mets know that from '88, where they were, you know, they beat the Dodgers all seven times that season. They were way better than them in the regular season. Yeah, like you see that happen in baseball a little bit too often, I think, to want more teams in the playoffs. The way playoffs work in any sport is you're always going to get bigger. You know, we've seen it. I think in every, you know, the NHL with the pandemic expanded their postseason. Otherwise, they've been at 16 for a while. But the NBA basically expanded it with the play-in tournament this past year. The NFL just expanded to 14 from 12 after being there for a while. You know, college football, which is, I think, the sport that needs a lengthy playoff as much as any other because of the scheduling imbalance and the few bases of comparison. Like, they're going to go from 4 to 12 or whatever in the next couple of years. I think baseball is probably the sport that, like, if I were running it, I would make sure there's no more than 12 that make the postseason. And I'd make sure that, like, winning your division meant a lot.
I think that's a key. Because, like, I think, like, the only way I could abide more teams in the postseason would be if you make it significantly harder. And they've done this to some extent, but, like, significantly harder for the lower-seeded teams to advance. And that's, like, you know, play-in games like they've had. I loved the idea of, like, the two-game series. Like, the lesser team, the higher-seeded team only has to win one, and the lesser team has to win two, which I think Theo Epstein has proposed that a few years back. But I do think, like, yeah, to make it, to keep the regular season relevant, you have to give a ton of value to the divisional titles in the postseason.
Yeah, I agree with the two games, you know, and I think you can apply that not just to the wild card game, like you can apply that to other series. If you want to make the division series a four-game series, essentially,
mm-hmm.
Where you give the team with the better record starts the series up 1-0, essentially.
Right,
I'd be okay with that. It would really make team.
It would shorten the postseason, which I think a lot of people would think is too long as it is, and it would not make it any less exciting.
Right. So, or you know, you play around with home field advantage in those situations. So, I think there are ways to fix to advantage certain teams in the postseason better than what baseball does to this point, so that you get the best regular season teams playing in the World Series more consistently. But that is the brief introduction to why the playoffs are not 16 teams in Major League Baseball on a regular basis. You know, I think it was okay because the Astros had a long track record of being a good team, but like we came one game away from a sub 500 team playing in the World Series
right.
last year in Houston. Like that would have, you know, if that were Milwaukee in the National League or Miami. I guess Miami was over 500, but the
Marlins
31-29 Marlins had, you know, beaten the Cubs in the first round and then beaten the Braves and upset the Dodgers strangely in the NLCS, like, and then got on to play in the World Series or win the World Series. Like that would have felt, I think, very fluky, and you don't want your champion to feel fluky ever as a professional sport.
Take that, three-time world champion San Francisco Giants of the early 20-teens. Thank you. A huge thank you to Philippe for the question. We really appreciate listeners anywhere who want to get after us. I'm at OG Ted Berg on Twitter. Tim is at Tim Britton. You can email AskTedBerg@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. We will be back, barring unforeseen circumstances, to discuss the trade deadline in greater depth as it approaches. Until then, Tim, peace out.
And Philippe, can you email one of us to tell us whether you've been to O'Leary's, the Boston sports bar in Sweden, and whether it's good or not? Because I'm still interested.
I forgot about that unsolved mystery from earlier in the podcast. So yes, Philippe, please let us know.
Adios.
Peace.